ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if the most ordinary things in your life aren't ordinary at all? A toothbrush, the pockets in your jeans, even a gravestone. Someone designed them, shaped them, argued over them, and got it so right, you've stopped noticing. The everyday is full of hidden ingenuity, and on By Design with me, Anthony Burke, we pull it all into the light. Search for By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar. This is All in the Mind, Mailbag Edition. We've got clinical psychologist Dr. Lindsay Gibson back on the show this week. Her books are all about the relationships between parents and children, where they can go awry, how to recover, and how to repair them. And on last week's show, we spoke to Lindsay about her newest book, How to Raise an Emotionally Mature Child. And off the back of that, we asked you for your questions about your own parent-child relationships. Oh my gosh, did you deliver? We had a ton of really thoughtful emails into our inbox. We heard from many people who are trying to figure out how to deal with the damage inflicted on them in childhood. We also heard from a few people who realized that they might be an emotionally immature parent themselves, or perhaps were one in the past.
When you begin to get a little bit of self-insight and awareness of how you may have affected other people, there's a terribly difficult transitional time. You can see the damage.
And plenty of people also said Lindsay's first book, Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, and our first interview with her way back in 2021, changed their lives. So let's just jump straight in. Here are your questions for author and clinical psychologist, Dr. Lindsay Gibson. Let's start with people talking about their own parents. So Lisa asks, I am a mum of two teens, and I've been estranged from my emotionally immature mother for several years now. I'm the eldest daughter, and I was always treated differently to my other siblings. In short, I'm the scapegoat, and my siblings often don't fully understand my experience with her. I have two questions, and both these questions are great, so I'm going to keep them in. First one, let's do that one first. How much of this dynamic tends to relate to birth order, gender, temperament, or the specific role a child occupies in the family?
Yeah, that is a phenomenon that's been fascinating to me. How is it that different children can end up with such different types of relationships with the same parents? It's just fascinating to me.
Yeah.
One of the best explanations I ever heard was from a friend of mine, Tiffany Wentz-Root, who's also a therapist. And her idea was that a lot of times the parent will sort of pick out one child to be almost like a co-parent or a caretaker. The parent doesn't fuse or enmesh with that child psychologically in the same way that they might with younger children.
Mm.
So that older child, or it could be just an identified child, it could be a particularly capable or responsible or sensitive child who automatically, sort of by temperament, steps up and starts to take on some of the responsibilities in the family or tunes into mom or dad and what they need. And then that child kind of becomes parentified because the parents notice that they have this asset that, you know, can help them run the family, so to speak. So it can be a combination of all different kinds of things that this person just mentioned. The problem is that when the person tries to go back to the parent and explain to them their particular experience and how it may have affected them, and the parent is saying, well, my other three children don't have any problems with me. We get along great. I'm not sure it's me. Maybe it's you.
Mm.
And there's no way for a person to come back to that with any kind of answer that, you know, makes them feel better. They just wonder why they've been the one who's been picked out.
Lisa's second question is one that a couple of people also raised. It was, What about the impact of the more emotionally stable parent who passively enabled the situation? As an adult, it can be really confusing to realize that the kinder parent you felt safest with also failed to protect you. How is that dynamic understood psychologically?
Well, this kind of goes back to what I noticed when I was researching the types of parents that my clients had who really fit the overall bill of emotional immaturity in terms of their egocentrism, their inability to reflect on their own behavior, their poor empathy, their avoidance of emotional intimacy. I mean, those were sort of the hallmark characteristics of parents that were emotionally immature. But I found there were four types. And one of those was the type that I called the passive type, meaning that they usually are the favorite parent because they're not actively demanding attention or getting angry at the child or acting out in any particular way. They're certainly not rejecting the child, but they're also not protecting the child.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of times the passive parent is kind of like a kid themselves. They can be fun. They can be close to the children. They have more empathy for the children because I think they kind of identify with the children kind of being treated badly by that other parent.
Mm.
But it doesn't seem to spark an adult urge to do something about it to protect that child. So it can lead to just this kind of feeling like, where were you when I needed you? And why didn't you step in to do something to shield me?
Yeah. And we had a couple of people ask about how to process that realization because, you know, people spoke about the grief and sadness they felt about realizing the parent they feel close to actually failed them as well.
I mean, that's exactly it. When somebody asks, how do I process the grief and the anger? To me, that tells me that they are about 80% there already. Just
the recognition.
Yeah, but by knowing that's what they feel toward that parent. Because a lot of times when people first come into therapy and they're telling me about the dynamics, lots of times they paint a picture as if they have this one perfectly emotionally healthy, good parent. You know, it could be the father, could be the mother. That was a source of love. That was a source of their sense of being understood and cared for. And that was the, you know, quote, good parent. But then you hear stories like one woman who, when her mother was beating her, she would hear her father in another room, you know, doing something, making noise. And she interpreted it that he was helping her by letting her know that he was around.
He was helping the child.
Yes, almost like comforting her. This is the way she read it. He was comforting her by letting her know that he was still there, but he's not doing anything to stop the beating.
Yeah.
But so when you have a person like that who uses that as an example of how good and loving that passive parent was, it's a huge development for them to get in touch with their anger at why nobody, I mean, just like it never occurred to them that somebody would step in and stop it. So they begin to have anger at that. And then they have grief because that really was the parent that they had the strongest attachment to. And honestly, they really did get a lot of good emotional connection going with that parent. So we can't minimize that or the grief of realizing that at some level, some deep level, that parent really let them down.
What's your message to parents, people who might identify as the passive parent then? Because I imagine, you know, they should intervene surely, but perhaps people have kind of learned helplessness in this kind of situation where they know it's not going to have an effect and divorce is not an option for whatever reason. So perhaps they realize their only option is to be silent and provide some sort of buffer for the kid. If that's like the kind of conundrum they find themselves in, what would be your message to a passive parent?
Well, I'm sure that happens all the time. I mean, I've seen it a lot. And the parent really does feel like, I mean, they are actively thinking, you know, should I leave her? Should I leave him? Would the kids be better off if I did that? Would the disruption of divorce be worse than what we're going through now? And then the other thing is for various reasons, they don't feel like splitting up is a really an emotional option for them. So they have really, I love that term that you use, learned helplessness, because they have really learned to just kind of back off and you know, give into the helplessness, give into the passivity, because they really can't see a good solution.
So what is something they can do to try to protect their kids? Do you have any?
So if the passive parent had gotten to the point where they wanted to change or they wanted to do something to protect the child, I mean, that's when you do start to get into the, you know, land of divorce, because they begin to take action, they begin to set limits, and they begin divorce proceedings, and then you get into custody battles and, you know, all that. But, you know, it's, if you have grown up with an emotionally immature parent yourself, and now you are a passive person yourself up against a very, often a very demanding, emotionally immature spouse, it's really hard for you to suddenly muster the confidence and the ability to take a stand and do something to help the child. You really are not prepared for it.
Someone I'll call Nina asks, I have emotionally immature parents, and I come from a Chinese background where estrangement is not very common and almost taboo. I've made strides in setting boundaries for myself, but as I grow stronger in my personhood, I feel the gap between me and my parents growing. I'm not sure I'll be able to ever cut them off. Nothing unforgivable has happened, but our relationship is a collection of small but continuous sadnesses. In your experience, is it possible to stay in this state of being, or does it always come to a point where one has to make a choice between contact or little to no contact?
Well, aren't we all in that position of deciding how much contact we want with someone? She's asking the question from the standpoint of sort of the status of the overall relationship. I understand that. But, you know, whether it's a friend or a spouse or kind of a buddy, we're always kind of having to decide whether we want to be with this person and spend time with them or not.
So she's got like a false binary happening here, perhaps? She can be okay with being in the middle ground between the two options?
Absolutely. I love that, the false binary, because lots of times emotionally immature people, because they're such rigid black and white thinkers, and they don't see complexity, they don't see the gray areas, they don't like ambiguities or nuance. They want everything to be, you know, so it's like, if you love me, you will see me every week, or you will see me every month, or, you know, whatever the number is that is meaningful to them as proof of love. So the child, the adult child, could get sucked into agreeing with that. Like, oh, yeah, you're right. There is this international law that you have to see your parents every month or you don't love them. I know that. You're right. You could do that. Or you could say to yourself, wait a minute, I'm a person here too. She's not, you know, by fiat, she's not the most important person in the relationship. I can decide how much time I want to spend with her. And in addition, that will probably make me enjoy the time I do spend with her much more than feeling obligated to come a certain number of times or it's under certain, for certain events. So it's really important to sort of shake off that spell that emotionally immature people can cast on their children to make them feel guilty or ashamed or self-doubting, because that's really an attempt to control the child and for the parent to dominate them in order to meet their emotional needs, which is to be the most important person and have everybody interested in keeping you stable and reinforcing your self-esteem. That is what the emotionally immature person thinks that they need. So for this person, for her to step back and just ask herself, how many times or under what conditions and for how long could I visit mom and come away feeling like I had fulfilled some kind of value for myself, you know, that I did something I feel good about as a daughter. But I'm not feeling exhausted and I'm not feeling bitterly resentful because I'm having to upturn my life to meet this schedule that she's imposing on the relationship.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. The cultural element is so real. Like I know from my own relationship with my parents and the culture I grew up in, there is one parent who I don't see as much, but I don't feel comfortable cutting them off. And I don't think I'd ever really consider that because I think they would actually loom larger in my psyche if I did that. But also, I don't think it was bad enough to require that. But I do limit contact almost. I don't even think about it that much, but, you know, it's limited when I do see them. But those times are wonderful. Like I can enjoy them because I know they're small doses and they don't have to be quite so frequent.
Yeah. And because you have some control, you have a sense of control over it, that you have made the choice to spend the time with them. And that is so important because how can you feel love for anybody who's controlling you or guilting you?
I mean, I definitely get a bit of guilt tripping still, but you know, I'm pretty comfortable saying no or making excuses. So
and you know, we forget they're grown-ups too. And so to have someone say no to you or to say, you know, I'm sorry, that's not going to work for me, but I could do this. Would you want to do that instead? We forget that that is the way that it has to be. I mean, if you're going to continue a workable relationship, once you become an adult and on your own, it becomes a relationship between two adults. It's not between a parent and child. If you try to hang on to that kind of role play with your adult child, you're going to be moving further away from them than getting close.
Okay, a few people ask variations of this next question as well. Someone we'll call Aaron asks, how do you care for an elderly parent who ridiculed you and was emotionally absent when you were a child and continues to berate you and your family as an adult, but you have to care for them now? Other people, when they asked this question, they kind of talked about, you know, being in the situation, elderly parent who is not great to them, and now being tempted to enact a kind of revenge by subjecting them to kind of invalidating behavior and being like, see how it feels when you're vulnerable. So a few people have elderly parents they're dealing with who were emotionally mature in their own childhood and they're struggling now.
Yeah. So the idea that you have to absorb whatever it is that the elderly parent is putting out, and that somehow you're a good person if you don't have any personal reaction to that and you just sort of chalk it up to them being older. Somehow, you know, that can be seen as the desirable way to do it, but it's not sustainable. And really what happens when a parent is older is that lots of times if they're, for instance, if they're living with the adult child, for instance, lots of times they really are not running the show anymore. And it's important for the adult child to recognize that the roles have shifted. And now that this is their home, or they're the ones who are shouldering the care of the parent, they have a right to be treated in a respectful way. And they can start setting limits with the parent or setting boundaries on what they will listen to or what is okay to say or not say. They can bring interactions to a close. They can walk away. They can say, Mom, when you say that to me, it hurts my feelings. Please stop. And of course, they're not going to get a, oh, I'm so sorry, honey. I didn't know that I was making you feel bad. They're not going to get that. They may get more blowback, but you still, once you feel like you don't have to take that, it really does something inside to your feeling of efficacy, your feeling of freedom. You can even work through a lot of old stuff when you're forced into a situation like that with a parent, because after a while, it just becomes psychological survival where you begin to, you know, set these limits, or you begin to remove yourself from the room when they start up, or you tell them, I can't talk to you anymore if you're going to use that kind of language, or, you know, whatever the limit might be.
It sounds like a very tricky situation all around, though, to have to be in such close contact with a parent when they're frail and older and who was terrible to you.
No, it really is. And there are lots of situations that are so constrained by finances and how many advantages you have. In other words, if there were the possibility of them being cared for in a retirement home, that would be great. Lots of times people have the means to do that, but they want their child to take care of them. Meanwhile, the child is you know, under a tremendous burden, and it's not good for their health or their mental health. So anybody in that situation really needs outside support. They need therapy, or they need a support group, or they need some place where they can get the empathy that obviously that parent is not going to be giving them, because it's a tremendous psychological job.
Yeah, you got to figure out how to cope with the cards you're dealt, I suppose. Okay, a couple of people who recognize their own behavior as not being great. Someone I'll call Ainsley asks, I don't remember my own parents being particularly emotionally immature. However, after listening to the episode with Dr. Lindsay Gibson, I recognize I might be. I find myself to be emotional and triggered by my children's big feelings, sometimes even angry. What are some things I can do to prevent any negative impact this may have on my own children?
Well, first of all, hats off to anybody that notices that their behavior may be affecting their children negatively or may have affected them negatively. I mean, how courageous is that, that you are looking at your own behavior, you know, and it's probably painful to do that. Mm. Nobody wants to think that they have caused their child any harm or unhappiness, really. What we have to realize, though, is where you end up is what you have to deal with. So let's say that you recognize that maybe you weren't as understanding or patient or thoughtful as you wish you had been with your children. And now you're seeing the results of that in some way. You cannot swim back upstream and fix that, but you can right now attempt to have a more adult, considerate, respectful relationship with them as the adults they are now.
For this person, I get the sense that her children are still young from the way she's written her question. So I don't know if that changes your advice at all.
Yeah, it does. Because if you are still caring for your children, if they're still dependents in your home, and you're looking back and wishing that you had done something different, then what a perfect opportunity to take parenting classes, to get parenting books, to join parenting groups, to watch TV shows on it. I mean, you can get so much education for so little output right now in terms of what works best with children. And so no matter when you start it, it's all to the good. It's just like if you were in a relationship with another adult and, you know, they had maybe had treated you not so well and you'd been unhappy with them. And then somehow they begin to realize what they've been doing and they start to change and they start to treat you with respect and they really are working on themselves. I mean, we know what that would feel like. We know what it feels like to be apologized to or to have someone say, oh, whoops, I'm starting to give advice. Let me back up for a second. Please go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It feels good and you feel closer to them and the relationship starts to, you know, build on a stronger basis when you do that.
Yeah, I will say in terms of how she's written that question as well, I don't know all the details of what's going on there, but from what she said, it doesn't necessarily sound like emotionally immature behavior. It sounds like someone who might be overwhelmed or learning how to parent, like, you know, who hasn't been emotional or triggered by their children's big feelings and gotten angry. Like, that sounds pretty standard parenting.
Yeah, and we have to be aware of that. If we're trying to never do anything wrong with our children, that is putting so much pressure on ourselves that we're probably going to end up working against the very thing we're trying to do because it's going to make us stressed and we're not going to be, you know, in that nice fluid state of self-confidence that we need to do parenting day in and day out.
Okay, this next question is also from a parent grappling with their behavior, but it's kind of more on the serious end compared to what Ainsley wrote. So I wonder again if your advice changes here. Someone I'll call Jay says, I have caused damage to my relationship with my now adult children. My partner and I separated when they were 9 and 12. It was not very amicable, and I had mental health issues, which led me to be hospitalized many times for attempted suicide. I've also struggled with alcohol dependency. The adult children have distanced themselves from me and are almost at the edge of giving up on me. I'm interested to know how to make steps to repair faith in me. I have been working on myself for years. I have made many positive changes, but it doesn't seem to be acknowledged because I do still have issues that do come up. How do I talk to them and explain slash prove to them that I am trying?
That is such a poignant example of someone who has grown to the point where they can now self-reflect and they can have a sense of how their behavior, how their reactions may have affected their children. And also you can sort of read between the lines that this person was struggling with such big feelings, with such despair, with such helplessness, that they couldn't do anything except what they did. They were trying to survive, probably, because those are the kinds of extreme behaviors that people use when they can't find any other way of coping. So when you begin to get a little bit of self-insight and awareness of how you may have affected other people, there's a terribly difficult transitional time where you now know, you have enough distance from that previous self, so to speak, that you can see the damage. And that's a very painful thing to really admit to yourself and work on in therapy, which it sounds like this person is doing. The problem with emotional immaturity, and let's be honest, the problem with being human is that we are so impatient with the growth and recovery process. That's good because we want to be motivated. We want to be, you know, forward moving. We want people to keep trying. But really, when it's psychological and relational rebuilding, that takes a long time. And it's not enough for you to have the awareness of what you did and the intent to make it better and to make yourself more mature and more able to cope. That's not enough to turn the relationship around. That's going to take time. And the only thing that really helps there is consistency, non-reactivity, patience, and kind of a gentle, respectful reaching out, showing concern and consideration for your children. It's just like any relationship that has had a breach. It takes a long time to rebuild that relationship. You have to build relationship trust back bit by consistent bit.
Yeah, I guess if it was a long way down, it'll be a long way up.
And I have full sympathy and full understanding, though, that once you have that insight about why you were that way, of course you want to use that as a way of repairing the relationship. Unfortunately, that doesn't do it for the other person. What does it for the other person is that you show over time a willingness to respond differently.
Okay, to finish, we had a few questions on dealing with grandparents and grandchildren when you're the child of an emotionally immature parent. So like one person wanted to know how to enable their children to have a relationship with their grandmother who was in fact very emotionally damaging to them growing up.
The question that goes through my mind is, why would you want to expose your child to this person?
Keeping the peace and facilitating some semblance of a relationship is what she writes.
Yes, but at what cost? I mean, it you can't tell from, you know, a single question like this how serious the behavior is of this grandparent, and, you know, whether it's just snarkiness or cynicism or whether it's outright verbal abuse. I mean, it's hard to tell.
Well, let me give you one example. She says she was this neurospicy middle child, and she was always the family scapegoat, framed as a problematic one. My mother even used to joke about picturing my face on a boxing bag at the gym to vent her frustration. And yet she wants to maintain some sort of connection between her daughters and this mother.
Yeah, well, there is a strong cultural ideal that you have, you know, grandparents, and that your children should have contact with their grandparents because, you know, there's grandparents' day at school and all the other kids have relationships with their grandparents and et cetera. But it really depends on what you think would be best for your child. To me, that's the most important thing. Now, a possibility might be if that person had a problematic relationship with, you know, with their parent, they could certainly just keep an eye on how that grandparent is interacting with the child. In other words, don't leave them alone with grandma for the weekend until you are sure that they're not going to be saying things like the punching bag thing. Because sometimes, you know, people mellow, and like we've seen in so many of these questions, they really do start to reflect on things that they've done wrong. And they're not under the same kind of stress as an older person, usually. And they have room for the kindness and compassion and the fun-loving grandparent. They have room for that now. And so sometimes they can be a much better grandparent than they were a parent. But you won't know that unless you take on the responsibility of observing the interaction between your child and the grandparent. Like I had a client once whose mother would come to visit, and she would try to engage the child and would, and the child had, you know, was doing something else, but the mother was trying to get attention directed toward her. And this is very common. The child is sort of feeling badgered to engage with grandma. Uh-huh. So at that point, the parent can step in and say, "Mom, he's playing with his truck now." Or, "Mom, why don't you give him a few minutes and try again later?" Or, I mean, you would think, oh, I shouldn't have to tell another adult that when the child is plainly rejecting you to lay off and back up. But that's exactly what had to happen because this parent, this grandparent, really didn't have the sensitivity to read that cue from the child. So if this person observes the grandparent's behavior, it feels benign to them, that's your answer. It's not bothering the kid. It's not, they're not having your childhood with your parent. But you won't know that until you really are observing it and you're there to see it.
And if you start seeing the same toxic behavior patterns, then reconsider how much contact, I suppose.
Yes, and also to have the conversation with the grandparent later. It could be that it's necessary at times to do it in the moment in front of the child. Like, "Mom, don't do that. We don't hit in this house," or "We don't yell in this house," or whatever it might be. I mean, the correction might need to happen in the moment. But there can be the conversation of, "You're doing this with my child, and I can't let that go on because I think it's hurting their feelings. That doesn't feel good to them. So what do you think we can do about that?" To engage the parent in some kind of, you know, collaborative problem solving, because I can't in good conscience let them come over and have you talk to them that way.
Yeah. Lindsay, I could ask you so many questions. That was like a fraction of what people sent us, but I'll end it there because we only have so much time. Thank you so much for responding to our listeners' questions.
Oh, they were great questions. And believe me, they're not the only people in the world that have those questions.
That is clinical psychologist and author Dr. Lindsay Gibson. We've done a couple of episodes recently on parenting. If you want more on this subject matter, take a listen to our episode with Dr. Billy Garvey. He's a developmental pediatrician and the co-host of the podcast Pop Culture Parenting, as well as an author. It aired a couple of months ago, but we'll link to it here in our show notes. And that is it for All in the Mind this week. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr, senior producer James Bullen, and sound engineer Roy Huberman. I'm Sana Qadar. Thank you for listening. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.